Welcome to Alchemical Dialogues, an Amber Light podcast. Join Dr. Henry Crutella and Paul Brew for their discussion on finding one's own relationship with spirituality. The information provided on this website and these podcasts is for informational purposes only. Nothing on this website and in these podcasts is intended to be a substitute for medical, health, therapeutic, diagnosis, or treatment. The opinions expressed by the guests in these podcasts are not necessarily the opinions of Amber Light International and anyone associated with this organization.
Welcome, everyone. Today, we have a conversation with Paul Brew. Thank you, Paul, and welcome.
Thank you, Henry. Thank you for having me.
Little introduction. Paul is formally trained as a historian and is an adjunct teacher at local colleges around Rochester, New York. However, his life travels have taken him from Eastman Kodak, an advocate for LGBTQ rights, glassmaking, photography, including I'm So Jealous, a class with Ansel Adams, martial arts. He carries a fifth degree black belt, I believe. And I love this, a hate-love relationship with religion. As I hope we get to talk about, he was sharing with me that his extensive reading and life experiences actually brought him from a kind of hatred of religion to a love of mysticism. And he says, if you want to be kind, think of me as a spiritual Renaissance man. Thank you again, Paul. That's a wonderful synopsis you gave.
Thank you.
So we were talking and you said, and again, we don't script these, but just to get a general idea of what direction we might go. You said something that really hit me, that it was really important to you that people know that in terms of spirituality and personal growth, you started from ground zero. And I was really struck by that, that it was so important for you that people hearing this podcast know that. Can you talk about that a little?
Oh, absolutely, sure. To start with ground zero, you have to deconstruct your life a little bit. And yeah, I look back at my spiritual growth and say it started to fall apart with my family, probably about the same age as I understood religion. I knew it wasn't working for me. You're talking about a boy who was born in 1956. By the time I was 5 or 6 years old, I kind of knew what the Catholic Church was all about and that we were supposed to go on Sundays. And that father was mean, and nuns did slap your hands with a ruler. And I was kind of afraid of church. I was always looked at it as like, oh, this is the big place. This is where you got to tell the truth about anything you did wrong. You know, if you don't do what they tell you, you could end up really bad. So it started to be a relationship of fear. And then layer on top of that, a dysfunctional family that was working its own issues. I think I told you before, I don't consider my life a tale of woe, but I do consider it a tale of impact. It is certainly a lot of negative stuff impacted me early on and drove me away from religion. My mom was codependent to my alcoholic father, both of them, of course, working their own dramas from youth and imprinted on me. My mom was very, very big into the church, very big into the guilt and confession. You got to do right. You can't do this. You got to do that. My dad was a little bit more easygoing about religion, to tell you the truth, but still he was the heavy in the house. He was the abusive alcoholic. And I think I told you, one of the things I just knew about the church, I mean, nowadays they made a big, huge movement out of it, and it was like a big eye-opener. But when I was a boy, it was like, we all knew that. I remember I was 7 or 8, and the priests liked to have young boys as altar boys. And my mom, at the dinner table one day, said, I talked to father, he'd like Paul to be an altar boy. My father put down his knife and fork and he looked over at her and he said, that's not going to happen. And I was there like, thank you. Because we all knew that it was bad. You didn't want to be the altar boy. And then about the time I was 10, I was old enough to say no. My mom wanted me to go to church and I didn't want to go. And my dad said, he's old enough to choose for himself. What neither one of them knew was that about the age of 10, the boys in the neighborhood we were doing what little boys do. We were swearing. We were trying out. You ever get a brand new swear word and you try to conjugate it when you're 10? Is it a verb? Is it an adjective? Is it a noun? Can it work as all three in the right sentence? So I remember the word was faggot. And I didn't know what that was. And I asked Paul Bissell, I asked the neighbor boy, he was 15 or 16 at the time. So he told me. And I remember very clearly thinking, oh my God, that's me. Oh, that's me. Because I was experimenting with the other boys sexually in the neighborhood. We didn't consider it weird. We just considered it something, you don't tell mom that. You know, so suddenly I was there like, yeah, that's me. I like boys. I don't like girls. So I very quickly, almost immediately, went into the closet. And then the messaging of the church, the messaging of my parents started this thing as, you can't be that. I remember my mom talked about, you know, what she called those homosexuals about the same age and about how they were going to hell and God hated them. And I was like, you ever see that Mel Gibson movie, Lethal Weapon? I saw it in the theater, and the line he used about God hates me, hate him back, it works for me. I remember watching that movie, and I was, in my early 30s at the time, and I distinctly remember, you stole my line. Because that was my attitude. Did not want anything to do with God, did not want anything to do with church. The only time from about the age of 10 until I was in my early 30s that I walked into a church was if it was a wedding, if it was a funeral, or if my mother guilted me into doing it on Christmas Eve. Had no interest whatsoever, considered it a scam. I could probably best be termed as an atheist at the time, but then maybe not, because I hated. God hated me, I hated him back. So how can you be an atheist if you are in this hate-hate relationship with someone? Can't not believe you're real if I hate you.
Do you think that was just about your being gay, or were there other things?
There were all kinds of things. You know, different things happened to different people in my life. How the church reacted, what I saw from various churches. I've always been, since the earliest grade, I've always been really big into reading. So I'm reading lots and lots of history. I'm reading lots of philosophy. Even I remember I was 14, I read Plato. You know, I did lots of reading. I have a deep love of science fiction. And reading makes you think. And the more I thought about religion, the more I'd be like, this is wrong. This is about people telling each other what to be and who to be and how to be. And everything's about going to hell or heaven or raising money or persecuting someone because they did something that you didn't like, more than just being gay. But I would say that for me, that was a central piece of it.
Right.
And it got worse and worse because you're hiding in the closet and you're also have these massive anger issues at the world and God. Went suicidal when I was 18. Never did it, thankfully. But I remember the night I graduated, I went home from my little party and I said, that's it. Tonight, you kill yourself or you make a life for yourself. Which one are you going to do? Well, I chose to make a life for myself. And a very successful life, I got to say. I look back at the things I've done and I'm very proud of them. I worked at Bausch & Lomb. I learned to make glass from scratch. Learned handcrafting and the importance of apprenticeship. That was just an amazing experience. Switched jobs. Went to work for Eastman Kodak Company. I thought I was going to make glass for them. They had me doing photographic paper. As I said, I got to take, they used to have what's called the teach-ins. And I was there the year that they had Ansel Adams come in and do a teach-in. That was amazing. That was just amazing. The guy, we drove out to Bergen he was going to show us how to do pictures. So they had a van, they bust us all out to Bergen, and he just sat there in the van, and we were like, this is boring. And he's just chatting to people. Then he looked up, the clouds passed, he walked out, and he clicked one click of his camera, and he says, let's go. And he was right. It was all about the light. He took an awesome picture.
Wow.
But, you know, things like that taught me some values that I don't think you can get anywhere else. And then again, more and more reading.
Had you been reading into mysticism at that point?
Yes and no. I'm an eclectic reader, and I like to read the philosophers. Stumbled upon the Quran when I was about 15. Not a very good read. Not for a 15-year-old.
I was going to say it was quite a stumble, right?
Yeah, but just stumbled at it. And I was there like, I wondered what it was all about. I says, well, here's somebody who's got a different take on the same quote-unquote God. And I says, I wanted to see what it was all about. So read a little bit of the Lotus Sutra when I was about 17 or 18. That did not ring for me at all. But to tell you the truth, I think in my teens and my 20s, the closest I got to religious reading was science fiction. I think people really do not appreciate how many science fiction writers deal with spirituality. John Conroe and Robert Heinlein, and just a long list of people who've explored the divine through the idea of they have to create it from scratch, because nobody wants to read a book about something you already know. So they wanted a new take on why people would have worship, why people would find a God that worked for them.
That really strikes me, because what I hear you saying is that, in a sense, the real sense of spirituality comes from something we call science fiction. And the religious texts you were reading, to you, if I hear you right, that was more like fiction. It's just such an interesting paradox.
Right now in my spiritual path right now, I consider myself very eclectic. I pick and choose what works for me. One of the things that works for me is a book that postulates that God gave you free will because he's bored. All right. If God knows everything and he sets all these things in motion, he knows what electrons do, and he knows the death of a star. He knows all the things of the universe that he created. But what he doesn't know is what you're going to do next. And that to God would be fascinating, to have something he didn't know, that when your job is to take the gift, the free will, live your life, and when you die, you get to have a conversation. I gave you free will. What'd you do with it? Why'd you choose that?
I like this. We can have alchemical dialogues with God.
Yeah. So that's one of the things I picked up along the way. And I think till I was in my 30s, I think science fiction was close enough. I didn't have a spiritual need, didn't find any reason to want to reach out to the world. And then one of the reasons I embraced the concept of mysticism is a lot of people misuse the term, I think. I think that to be a mystic is to have the real personal relationship with the divine. And I can name two times it really woke me up in my early 30s. One time I was hiking through West Canada lakes, went through a small little valley, a little stream, very beautiful. Suddenly it got totally quiet, dead still, and I started shaking. I was so afraid. Did not know why, did not know how, couldn't run, just kept walking, got to the other side. And it took me a long time to realize that the reason I was so upset was I was experiencing something I'd never experienced before. And that fear wasn't of what was there, it was that it was new and I didn't understand it. And then to put it in context, I mean, I didn't tell anybody about it because I said, so they're just going to say you're crazy. They'll say Paul, you're making it up. It was about 4 years later, it was 2 years before I came out. I was up in the Adirondacks near Paul Smith College, and they own a tract of land called Cathedral Pines. And I was in Cathedral Pines all alone. And it happened again. And this time I had experienced it before. So I just said, okay, I'm going to sit with it. And within a couple minutes, I had tears running down my eyes because it was just like, this is it. This is the universe. This is perfect. This is the universe talking to you. This is God talking to you, Paul.
How old were you then?
37.
Okay.
At the time. I says, this is it. This is a religious experience. It's the closest I could give it. It prompted me to start looking around and starting to do some reading. I didn't really get a good answer for mysticism until I met Dr. Carl Davila while I was 49 years old. I had just started at SUNY Brockport. I get my degree. And he's a Sufi. And we started having some conversations. My gateway, of course, was he was teaching an anthropology class on Islam. And we started talking about his own spiritual path. And his concept of being a Sufi was that if you treat God like he's in heaven, or you treat God like he's your father out there, you don't get it. God is your absolute best friend who's on your shoulder every second of the day. He says, if you can view God like that, we can have a conversation. I liked it. It resonated for me. And it started to tell me that, yeah, you can reach out. You can find a spiritual connection. I spent 25 years at Eastman Kodak. One of the things you don't ever want to do in your life is be a manager in a company that downsizes every month. You end up firing your best friends, and right. That hurts. Right. I bailed on Eastman Kodak before they could bail on me one day just because I said, I can't do this anymore. So I decided I was going back to college. I'd been out for about maybe 6 years at the time. I was in a committed relationship, and I thought my life was going really well. And I says, it's time to go to school. It's time to get the life you wanted when you were 18. So while I was in school, I started taking a lot of classes, ended up being a history major for some God knows why reason. But while I was doing all those studies, I found myself more and more pulled towards spirituality. My master's thesis is pre and post World War II morality. I did an independent study on paganism. What is it? I did a men's group. We worked on the book King Warrior Magician Lover, which is absolutely a book about spirituality for men. Over and over again, I kept getting called into doing the readings. I kept finding myself looking more and more at a spiritual path. Where are you in the world, Paul? What does this mean? And eventually I came to a place where I said, you got to make it. Nothing works for me. I took a class at MCC for Dr. Clark called The Psychology of Religion. Awesome class. And he had us touring different places to experience it. You were supposed to go out and experience it. So I went and spent a weekend with the Baha'i. I did another weekend at the Zen Center. I was like, none of this works. I think the Zen Center wants to track me down and kick me. I found out that whole empty your mind, think about nothing thing. It does not work. The best way for me to meditate is focus. I build castles. I sit there and I close my eyes and I build a castle on a mountain. That's not easy. Not when you're doing it stone by stone. But it certainly centers the mind, and it certainly gives you that peace that meditation that people speak about meditation that I've always said, like, I can't do that. Well, I found a way that works for me. We had our book club last week, and it was just like, you made a comment about there not being any pagans in the room. And I thought about it later. I says, wait a minute. I'm a happy pagan some days. I mean, my god of choice is the Irish god Dagda, because I love the fact that he was the god of the Druids, of knowledge and study and intellect. I love that he was the gods of the fields and berries. He created orchards. So if I need a god, I'll go pray to God, Dagda. I also have a good friend of mine who's Wiccan. She talked me into about, what was it, a year and a half ago, the Wiccans in the United States got together and put a binding on Donald Trump. So she talked me into doing the ceremony with her, and I was there like, you know what? I took that as serious as I ever did a Catholic Mass, but it served a need. At the time, it connected me to other people. It served a psychological need to do something spiritually. And that was kind of one of my epiphanies, is that a religion for me has to serve my life needs. I'm not here to agree with somebody else. I'm here to try to figure out how to be the best me I can be. So that's where it's the like, well, if something doesn't resonate and you're looking around and not finding anything, maybe you got to create it yourself. Maybe there's absolutely nothing wrong from cherry picking a little bit from all these really good sources, ranging from Hadith to Stranger in a Strange Land.
So two things, Paul. One is, at this point in your story, you're probably in your 50s?
Yeah, I think I had this fairly well resolved for myself about maybe 8 or 9 years. So I think it was coming together for me starting in around age 50. And I think I got a glimmer of personal satisfaction spiritually by about the time I'm 55.
Right. So two things. One is, I mean, you can look at it a couple of different ways. One is, you know, that's a common time for us to reevaluate what we're doing. And I was going to say for men in particular, but I don't know if that's true. People in particular to kind of to look at what's meaningful. That's one part. But related to that is the other side of the coin, where some people would say the older you get, the less likely you are to be able to change, which I have not, I mean, in my work as a psychiatrist, I don't believe that.
Maybe, and just personal experience, maybe for me, I'm unique in that way, because my life went on pause when I was 18 and decided to make a life for myself, because my drug of choice was work and money. I couldn't be a black belt in karate. I had to be a fifth degree black belt in karate. I couldn't raise tropical fish. I had to have 100 fish tanks. I couldn't go on vacation. I had to go on adventure trips to Costa Rica. So I used work and money as a way to hide. If somebody asked me why I didn't have a girlfriend, I'd be like, I'm working all the time. I'm too busy. I have 101 excuses. I had to fill up my time. So that was a great way to hide until I was in my late 30s. All this adult development I think people naturally go through was on hold for me. So when I came out, I was 42 before I ever started dating. Right. So the same thing somebody normally does at 13, I'm doing it at 42. I remember the first guy I dated, I basically bruised his ribs. I thought I'd killed him. He came up behind me. He came up behind me and gave me a hug. Well, nobody does that. I mean, not in my life. I'm not used to that. And I was surprised. So I gave him an elbow in the ribs. And I was like, maybe karate and dating don't go well together. Again, a lot of the social development stuff, and I think the resolution of your own existential condition, the resolution of your own spirituality, maybe that was put on hold as well.
Maybe. I just want to leave it kind of up in the air for a second, and I wonder what other people are thinking about that too. But also the other comment was, for a lot of us, and I guess I'm speaking for myself, that ability to have the freedom and the courage to know that what's out there isn't for you and to find your own way, that's not universal. I mean, we're in a culture, I think, that talks a lot about freedom, but actually we're very regimented. There's a way of learning. There's a curriculum you have to go through. There are churches you should belong to. If you belong to a church, then you're supposed to follow the dogmas of the church. Somehow you had this, I don't know the right word, this sense or this ability, this courage to kind of know that that just didn't sit right for you. And it may have taken you a while to act on it. but you've acted on it with vigor. I mean, this is really meaningful to you. Those two things about the issue about age and also just the issue about being able to have that freedom and that courage to know this is what needs to happen. It needs to be what I create to live a purposeful moral life.
Thank you, Henry. Thank you. You used a word, though, and I was trying to frame my thoughts for today. And I don't know if I own the courage 100%. I think a little bit of it is I own the fear. When I rejected Catholicism, when I rejected the belief system that my parents were trying to force me into, I was very cautious about not getting hurt again. I don't like getting hurt. I don't like emotional hurt, especially. So why would I expose myself to another system that might hurt me? The first thing I have to have is proof that you're not going to hurt me. The first thing I want is, are you a safe place? Right. Because if you're not, so my questions for religion, by about the time I'm in my 30s, my questions were usually when I'm doing my academic studies, when I was in my 40s, was, okay, what is their paradigm? How are they trying to control? What is their lie? What do you have to believe? And is that something that I would or would not believe? So I approached all the traditional religions very, very skeptically. Mm-hmm. Very skeptically.
Well, courage is the other side of fear, right?
I would agree with that. That's why I think you're very generous saying courage, but I want to get to that place by acknowledging that where it came from.
Right. But you could admit your fear. I mean, my experience is a lot of us deny the fear, deny what we're really feeling because we're not supposed to feel that way. This is supposed to be a trusting place. I mean, even in relationships, how many of us have been in relationships that may not have been very healthy, but we have this idea about, well, but I'm supposed to be in a relationship, or I'm supposed to be X, Y, or Z. And if it's not working out, then there must be something wrong with me, as opposed to maybe there's something wrong with the relationship or the situation that I'm in.
Yeah. Now,
there is some truth to saying that, again, I'm speaking kind of as a psychiatrist, not everything is individual psychopathology. It's that we live in a crazy system, and adapting to a crazy system is not necessarily a sign of health. It may save your life and you may have no choice, but that's not necessarily a healthy thing.
I agree with that 100%. Bill Kelly, you know Bill well. We've had some really great conversations, and some of them have been about spirituality and everything. And I kind of like taken by a conversation I had with him as he asked me about God. And I was there like, well, I absolutely believe in the divine. I absolutely believe in God, but I'm not buying into anybody else's belief in that. It's my belief in him.
Right.
And I don't do gods that are punishing. One of my favorite sayings, I wish it was a t-shirt. Good gods don't do hell.
Right.
I totally reject the concept of sin. I think way too many philosophers, in fact, you and I've had, I've done this critique before, too many people are working with a Western Abrahamic tradition and never even realizing they're doing it. The world's not broken. The world is what it is. It's a complex place just like we are. We're complex. We're good. We're bad. We're sometimes in between. We're brilliant and we're totally confused. We make awesome calls and we're totally stupid. This is a world of human beings. Why wouldn't the world mirror us?
Right.
There are things in the world that are awesome. Great science fiction book called The Seeker. At the end of the book, this transcendent being from outer space basically hauls these two humans up to task and says, all you're doing is complaining and telling me how you want me to fix everything. I've looked at the entire history of your species. You've never had it so good. And I buy that 100%. I mean, even in the midst of COVID and a lunatic in the White House and, you know, a lot of other problems, social unrest, racism. Yeah, we've got some really, really tough things to work through. But that's the nature of being human. God must be totally thrilled with us. Mm. He doesn't know how we're going to solve it or if we're going to solve it. But it must be fascinating to watch us muddle through.
So you lead me to one other thought, and then I want to open it up to people for comments and questions. But as you're talking, it's like, I keep on remembering that phrase, as above, so below, or also we're made in the image of God.
Yeah.
You gave a great description of humanity. And if that's in the image of God, well, that's an interesting take on God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Here's a serious question. And I'll postulate to the group or whoever. Would you want to worship a perfect God? I don't. I mean, I want somebody who knows what I'm going through. I want somebody who can have a little empathy. I don't want perfect. Normal is a setting on a dryer. Perfect is like a drink you get at the when you're like at the bus bar. But you don't, no perfect. No perfect in deity.
Maybe the gods in the ancient mythologies were more accurate then.
Oh, absolutely. One of the reasons I say I'm a happy pagan is because I think that the ancients got it right. You have to have a view of the design of the divine that resonates for you. Just like I connect to Dagda, an abused woman who is living through that kind of experience may find a lot more solace in Brigid than she would in Mary. So if you're a car mechanic or you're working with metal, you're going to find Vulcan is a heck of a lot more approachable as a deity than St. Paul.
Right. Paul, I want to open it up for questions. And Fizela, you sent something in on a chat. Maybe the God of the ancients was perfect, but now has dementia. Thank you, Fizela. Betty, you had a question?
I have a comment and would like to hear your perspective on this, Paul. As I was listening to your story, I agree, first of all, with Henry that it takes courage to own the fear and to choose life. And the other comment is, I sense that throughout your life, there's been an underlying thread, perhaps an underlying voice of wisdom, and would like to ask you for your perspective on that.
I'm going to go back and say that I'll take my lesson from Dr. Davila. And I think that the divine has always been on my shoulder. I don't think I always recognized that. I don't think that I was aware of where the inspiration came from. Much as I'd like to think that I self-created my life and everything that goes on. And I really do believe that the divine is like God wanting to know what you're going to do next. I don't think he's hands off. I don't think that divinity for me is lacks interaction. I think it is interactive. So I think that if you need, or I need a kick in the pants or a gentle nudge, it'll come.
Thank you so much. That's a really good point from the kind of Sufi mysticism that I'm involved with. Frequently talk about we're co-creating. We're co-creating everything. I mean, why? It explicitly is saying there's a relationship. Everything is in a relationship. And in fact, you know, there's some new scientific theories coming out that are saying what mystics have always said, which is everything vibrates. Every time you have a vibration, there's a relationship. You can't have a vibration without a relationship, because for every action, there's a reaction, even in the mystical spiritual world. So everything is relationship. And I think what I'm hearing as you're talking is you've been exploring your relationship with the divine. And you were not willing to take it as static, that there was this it out there, that it was only a one-way relationship and it never changed. But you somehow knew that you were in this together.
I agree. And that resonates for me in the now. I don't think it would have resonated for me as part of a conversation when I was 30. Uh-huh. But as I'm sitting here at 64, yeah, absolutely. Right. There is that peace. A stranger in a strange land, I grok, thou art God.
Elaine, do you have a question?
So as some of the people on this call might know, that my pathless path is probably similar, if one can use that word, with yours in some ways, and I, especially the science fiction way, but and others. So I resonate a lot with what you're saying. My question has to do with community or common language. So in other words, one of the reasons I feel that people often are attracted to, or possibly more importantly, stay with a particular path is because there are other people that they can relate to who mutually support each other and who use the same language and who have the same beliefs. But I think the beliefs are even less important in that scenario than the language. It's this ability to share these experiences, which often are very ineffable, especially if they're very idiosyncratic or if they're very internally unique, right? So it's hard to share those experiences with pretty much anyone. So my question really is about that sense of aloneness. You know, Wadud referred to it as, used the expression of having courage to, in a sense, be on one's own path that can fit in every path, but maybe isn't perceived that way. I've spoken a lot and would love to hear if you have any thoughts whatsoever or experiences dealing with those aspects.
I'm going to bring up two things. First of all, I've tried the community route. My partner at the time got me to go to Unitarian Universalism. I joined the Universalist Church. I still consider myself a member. Sat on their board for a while because I wanted a spiritual community that was open. I think that, at least for the downtown Universalist Church, I think that is true of them. I think they're very open to other people's spiritual paths. I don't go there anymore because I finally figured out that it's more of a political movement than a spiritual movement. And if I want a political movement, I'll go out and work on a campaign. I mean, it didn't resonate with me after a while, but I tried the community path. I think where I've come out on that is realizing that community is about a shared sense. And I think we all share a unique drive and goal. We cannot share the same journey. So I'm not perfect. My answers are not right. I know that. But I'm on my journey. Right? I think everybody here is on their own journey. Right? And that's the community to me, that if you're open enough to listen to somebody else's stuff, then we have our community. Right? But we don't have to agree. I would find that scary if everybody said, oh, Paul, you're right. I'm like, no, no, run away. I don't not want to be a prophet. It ends badly.
That's just so meaningful to hear you say that. Buddha's last words were said to be, follow the lamp within you. And we're, you know, the mystical path we're on, we're told that the founders of our path basically said, you know, don't turn into a cult of personality. You know, that it has to do with finding your own journey. But that is so hard for people to do. Once you start associating in a community, the tendency tends to be, well, we all have to agree. And then it turns into organization. Then it turns into dogma, which is, I think we're really on the verge of a new era coming in where that is not going to be the case.
I'm hoping you are correct.
Yeah, I'm hoping too.
I am seeing glimmers of it in life, but I see a backlash as well. I see the rise like never. I mean, I'm old enough to remember Father Coughlin and listening to your Bishop Sheehan on the radio and stuff, and my mother's picture of him, Second Coming.
We once did an introduction to Sufism, succession or something, and there was somebody who looked like they were pretty interested. And came in near the end and said, well, I tried to explain to my mother, this was a young adult, what you're saying. And my mother said, oh, they just can't take a stand. We were talking about the kind of Sufism that we practice. You know, Sufism is kind of like, well, it's the particular perfume of mysticism, because mystics are mystics, and this is just one particular style, but it's not the only style at all. So we were pretty open, and our version of practice is to include a lot of things from other traditions, including mantras from other traditions, and we do Ram Nam, and I do a lot of Buddhist practices because that's in my background as well, and there's some shamanic interest, and, you know, but there's still an umbrella that can kind of hold it together so you can have a conversation, and you can share something. And I just remember him coming back and saying, my mother says you just can't take a stand. And that carried more import to him than anything that we were talking about or modeling. You know,
did he understand the power of that, though?
The power of his mother?
No, the power of not taking a stand.
I don't think so. I think, so we were talking about courage and fear before. He was fearful, I think, that this is too open. I can't grab onto something. And, you know, I think the reason there are perfumes out there is to let you grab a hold of something for a little while, as long as you know it's not the be-all and end-all. It's just something you're holding on to so you can get a sense of what's happening and you can go in a direction. But that doesn't mean that that is the only thing that you can have. But I used to call the kind of universal Sufism that we're into, what I loved about it in the very beginning when I caught on, I would say it's like an organized supermarket. Everything that is important to me fits in this supermarket, whether it's psychology, philosophy, my interest in science, my interest in something meaningful that isn't dogmatic. This is it, you know? And yeah, I don't think he caught that.
We'll need to have some further conversations because you're sparking my interest in knowing more about what you were doing. But it certainly resonates for me that you have to have that supermarket mentality. Mm-hmm. And that when something resonates for you, take it. And if it doesn't resonate for you, why are you spending time with it? I have no, like I said, I have no problem worshiping pagan gods, but I have no problem with Santa Claus either. It serves a function. On Christmas Day, you got the little kids around you. You tell me Santa Claus isn't important, right? When Christmas is over, I leave them behind. Mm-hmm. I already told you, my own god of choice is Degda, but you know, it's not like there is an idol in the house. I don't pray to him for anything. It's just it resonates with me when I feel like I need something.
Some people can't leave it alone.
Yeah, that's why I said that.
They can't leave it alone.
The young man didn't recognize the power of not taking a stand. Just take it as it comes, take it as you need it, and let it happen.
Okay. So I want to make sure, any other comments? Bob?
I was just going to comment, and this is not criticism or an effort to convert you, Paul, at all, is that one of the things that I've learned for myself over time is that spirituality develops best in some sort of a context, that raw spirituality is really hard to get a handle on. So the image I created for myself to deal with that is that spirituality is, no pun intended, the angel food cake. Religion is the bundt pan. It works better if I can put it into some sort of a context. And I'm not saying that any one context is necessarily better than any other, except for the individual, but that just raw naked spirituality is, I can't get my head around. I can't keep it working for me. But if I put it in some sort of a context that I don't always agree with and don't always endorse to the nth degree, which will annoy the hell out of the powers in that context, but at least it helps me to keep it where I can use it.
Yeah, and Bob, I would say that I would agree with you for a lot of people, that is a true statement. I think what you just framed is very much truth. My own path has been different, though. The bundt cake pan, no, I'll have the messy goo on the inside the oven. I prefer that. Constraints and the boundaries of religions, the first thing I start doing is poking boundaries. I'm not being persuaded, I'm being told. And the best things that have always worked for me have been persuaded. I read Descartes. He made sense to me. He persuaded me. But if you read Descartes, he doesn't force you to accept it. He just says, here's my reasoning. So I think you're right, but that model doesn't resonate for me. I prefer the messy.
It is an interesting thought, though, imagining that people get more interested in the pan than in the cake.
Yeah.
Which is kind of, I don't want to eat a pan, you know, but that's what people do. Somehow the pan becomes the cake. So thank you. Other thoughts or Betty?
I just have one more thought I want to toss out there. I think The Happy Pagan would be a great title for a book.
There you go, Paul.
That'd be fun. The Happy Pagan. Of course, I dabble with paganism like I dabble with everything else. And I have friends who take it incredibly serious. I would be stepping on their toes a bit, I think. Yeah, my friend Nikki, she's very much the worshiper of the goddess. And they're like, no, okay, man, I'm not doing that. So, yeah, I step on her toes a bit, even though we both are resonate on many levels.
Yeah, we have a few minutes left. There's something I wanted to get to. You mentioned it in passing, and you said that you didn't exactly have a tale of woe. And when we were talking earlier, you mentioned that everything that happened to you led you to where you are now. And you're pretty darn happy.
Yeah. In history, the first time I came exposed to this was I was taking a class on historical perspectives and learning about what's called lachrymose history, which was coined to refer to what historians were doing with the Jewish experience. Mostly Jewish historians, by the way, talking about how the tale of the people was a tale of woe and this catastrophe with that catastrophe, and we are destined to suffer. And I took the term and I started applying it to myself, and I said, you know what? Yeah, I've had some rocky stuff happen in my life, some stuff I wouldn't wish on anybody, but it made me who I am. If I took those things away, if I took away the alcoholic father and gave myself the perfect dad, if I took away the codependent mother and gave a strong, nurturing figure, if I took away a homophobic society and gave a nurturing society, would I be me? And the answer is probably not. I would have made different choices. I would have had different perspectives. I would have had different things I was reading. I would have had different interests. I wouldn't be me anymore. And frankly, I like me. I like me just fine. So if I'm going to like me, I also have to embrace how I got here. And I have to say, I'm a product of all the things that happened and my choices about what to do about those things. Sometimes those choices were brilliant. Sometimes they were pretty lame. But I made the choices, and it got me to where I am. So I don't consider my life a tale of woe. I consider my life a tale of growth. And ask me again in 10 years. Ask me in 20 years. My journey's not over.
Right. To me, and I'm interested in what other people think, that is, you know, that's really a very profound reflection. And in many ways, I don't think our culture, our religions, and our spirituality actually reflect that. So I think one of the appropriate criticisms about my field of psychiatry is we pathologize too much. And medicine in general, always it tends to be looking at pathology and trying to correct and ease the suffering. It's never been very good at promoting wellness. But even attitudinally, I mean, there's this subtle thing that happens with that. So if you've been abused, then you must have, I'm exaggerating a little, but you must have sequelae of that are negative that you need therapy for and you need medicine. And it's none of that is a given. It depends on what we do with it. And it's not like admitting that you can have rocky times in your life, including pretty severe ones, that actually inform you so that you develop in a way that is that leads to happiness and fulfillment.
Yeah.
I don't think that our culture promotes that. And again, I don't think our spirituality. So a lot of spirituality that I've been exposed to, and then again, a new era is coming. It is so out there. It's relating to some God up in heaven, you know, very transcendent, staying away from the muck of the world as if the muck of the world is bad. It's the muck of the world that makes you spiritual.
Right.
You know, that's a very feminine, nature-oriented, paganistic kind of approach that I think is real, and we're getting to that more and more.
Religion is like, I think too often it tries to define you. You did this right, you did this wrong. You're good, you're bad. And what's the matter with you're complex?
Right.
I'll give you one antidote that rocked my world a little bit, because remember, I grew up at a time when I was being told that if you were gay, you were not only evil in the eyes of God, but you were going to grow up to go to prison for not more than 25 years. But there are all these things. And one of the lessons I got when I was a kid was that if you were gay, you were going to grow up to be a pedophile. Well, I never really bought it, but then again, I never really didn't either. So I do some work on the side. I do some psychological testing and have joined some men's groups. And one of the things you find out is that not everybody's experience of, you know, having sex as a minor is the same. I had a guy tell me, he says, oh, I was abused when I was a kid. And I says, well, I'm sorry to hear that. And he says, I wasn't. I loved every minute of it. Mm. It really rocked me, because I had to ask him some questions about that. And his perspective, his framing of what happened to him was totally outside of the norm for society. And here's a guy who was suffering in a lot of ways, but not about that.
Right.
But not about that. So the thing everybody wanted to cure him of, the thing that everybody wanted to give him solace over, the thing everybody wanted to codify about his life, he thought was wonderful.
Yeah.
It was the other stuff that he needed.
Right. So interestingly enough, I've heard stories like that too. Some stories that people have told me, friends, not in my work. I've read about that. It's interesting how it's not that you want to allow for or prescribe abuse. We're not saying that at all.
No, absolutely not.
What we are saying is you never know what the consequences are going to be, and they don't always have to be negative. So yes, you try to do what seems to be ethical and moral in the right way and protect people. But you don't condemn people when something happens to them as if they have to be a victim and they have to be ill.
Right. They're not broken. They're people.
Right. So that's, again, that's not a standard, I think, in our culture. We may be getting there, but, and so often it gets misinterpreted as, oh, well, then you think it's okay that this happens to people. No.
No.
No, not at all.
Not at all. Right. Exactly.
But it is okay that somebody can say, I have my own way of dealing with this. And actually, when I look back on it, it actually helped me. That is so hard, I think, for some people to wrap their minds around. You're not excusing, you're not allowing, but you're being real, because we are so different and complex. Hafizullah?
Many years ago, well, the backstory, which is that when my parents broke up, they both repartnered with active alcoholics. And being neurodivergent myself, I was often punished in both the home and at school for just being different. So fast forward to, I don't know, probably 5 or 6 years into my career, or perhaps my careen in the Sufi path, and my life had fallen apart, and I wound up on the doorstep of my spiritual mentor from Seattle to Southern California, having ridden Greyhound for quite a chunk of time to get there. And she put me on retreat, and probably I had just trashed a career and a relationship pretty much in one stroke. And I went into this retreat not caring if I died. And 3 or 4 days into this retreat, which was on silence, and I didn't see anybody or talk to anybody for 24 hours at a stretch, I was doing a practice that she had given me that was a kind of recapitulation of the soul's existentiation through human incarnation and back to source. And I suddenly had this almost like a stop action tableau of seeing that all of the abuse that I had gone through and the experiences I had as a kid and my weird family and my weird school system and the one or two adults who basically just accepted me the way that I was because they saw me, that all of that was my classroom to develop certain things in me and give me certain experiences. And that moment of recovering the memory of having made the decision to take human incarnation marked the expiration date of my ability to blame anybody for what had happened to me. And it totally took the wind out of the sails of the little ship of my self-pity, because the experience was so real and so presential and so immediate and so overwhelmingly powerful that I just had to drop all of the melodrama. And try as I might, because it was a long-standing habit, I couldn't get behind it again because I just knew better. So the next time something went sideways, I'd try to go, oh, you know, what does this always happen to me? And I would just like stop halfway through the phrase going, you know why this is shaping up the way that it is. And yeah, it's going to take a while to rebuild those sectors of my personality that were constellated around being a victim. And it took a few years, but I did it. And I actually don't see now, I don't see that any of us are any different in with regard to having chosen this human life. That's also not something that I will put as a should on anybody, because you get that awareness when you get it. And I don't really think the practice that I was doing really had anything to do with the experience. I think that was just there to get me out of my own way so that I could re-experience that decision of, I've got a job to do, I'm going there.
Thank you, Hafizullah. Thank you so much. Maybe we'll get to talk more about it on our podcast in September. Any last thoughts, Paul, about that or anything else you would like to close with?
I was really taken with his statement of ownership, of power, of I in making that choice. And I think when I listen to other people's spiritual paths, those are the ones that impact me the most, is when they talk about making choice, when they talk about taking a spiritual ownership of saying, I'm not a victim. I'm living a life. This is what I've got. This is what I'm making out of it.
Right. And we can have friends on the path. We can have mentors. But you just don't get away from it's your path.
Exactly.
Thank you so much. This was an inspiring, provocative conversation. I really appreciate it.
Anytime. Very much enjoyed it.
Yes, and maybe we'll do some more. Thank you. I'd like to invite you back.
If you find yourself enjoying our podcast, please do us a favor and spread the word. Tell a friend about it. Post it on social media. If you or someone you know would like to participate in a future podcast, please connect with us through the Contact Us page. See our events calendar page for dates to our next live podcast recordings. We'd love for you to participate and ask questions. Alchemical Dialogues are live and unscripted conversations recorded on Zoom, brought to you by the great folks of Amberlight International, a nonprofit organization co-founded by Henry Curtella, MD, and Kathleen Fitzpatrick, LCSW. We choose topics from our current social and cultural climate with an emphasis on humanism and spirituality.